Whoever does any work on it shall be put to death. You shall kindle no fire in all your dwellings on the Sabbath day. Moses said to all the congregation of the Israelites, "This is the thing that the Lord has commanded. Take from among you an offering to the Lord. Let whoever is of a generous heart bring to the Lord's offering gold, silver, and bronze, blue, purple, and crimson yarns, and fine linen, goat's hair, tanned ram's skins, and fine leather, acacia wood, oil for the light, spices for the anointing oil, and for fragrant incense, and onyx stones and gems to be set in the ephod and breastpiece. All who are skillful among you shall come and make all that the Lord has commanded." Then the congregation of the Israelites withdrew from the presence of Moses, and they came, everyone whose heart was stirred, and everyone whose spirit was willing, and brought the Lord's offering to be used for the tent of meeting, and for all its service and sacred vestments. And so they came, both men and women. All were of a willing heart, and brought brooches and earrings, and signet rings and pendants, all sorts of gold objects, everyone bringing an offering of gold to the Lord. And everyone who possessed blue or purple or crimson yarn, or fine linen, or goat's hair, or tanned ram's skins, or fine leather, brought them. Everyone who could make an offering of silver or bronze brought it as the Lord's offering. And everyone who possessed acacia wood of any use in the work brought it. All the skillful women spun with their hands and brought what they had spun in blue and purple and crimson yarns and fine linen. All the women whose hearts moved them to use their skills spun the goat's hair. And the leaders brought onyx stones and gems to be set in the ephod and the breastpiece, and spices and oil for the light and for the anointing oil and for fragrant incense. All the Israelite men and women whose hearts made them willing to bring anything for the work that the Lord had commanded by Moses to be done brought it as a freewill offering to the Lord. Moses then called Bezalel and Ophelad and every skillful one to whom the Lord had given skill, everyone whose heart was stirred to come and do the work. And they received from Moses all the freewill offerings that the Israelites had brought for doing the work on the sanctuary. They still kept bringing him freewill offerings every morning, so that all the artisans who were doing every sort of task on the sanctuary came, each from the task being performed, and said to Moses, "The people are bringing much more than enough for doing the work that the Lord has commanded us to do." So Moses gave the command, and word was proclaimed throughout the camp, "No man or woman is to make anything else as an offering for the sanctuary." So the people were restrained from bringing, for what they had already brought was more than enough to do all the work.
Friends, brothers and sisters in Christ, this morning we gather ourselves around God's ancient fire once again. Like workers finishing off a long day on a building project, settling in around a fire at the end of the day to catch our breath, rest our weary bones, to let all our cares float up like the smoke into the atmosphere, to stare at playfully dancing flames, to let our minds roam with the God who crafted the blueprint we follow. We pause to warm ourselves around God's ancient fire and today to consider what it means to follow a God of vision. As I mentioned at the beginning of the service, I'll mention it now. In your bulletins, you have a save the date for a congregational visioning process that will begin in January. Now, I've already referenced these visioning workshops a few times this fall, and well, let's be real. Visioning is probably the kind of word that could mean a lot of different things for a lot of people. For some of us, it can come with some pretty negative associations. If you mostly associate visioning with negative experiences you've had at work, I imagine that you could think of it like this. First, your boss enthusiastically invites you to set aside all your other work, which he or she still expects you to get done sometime, of course, and to join the rest of your workplace for an exciting adventure of visioning that you're just going to love. Also, it's mandatory. While attending said exciting and adventurous mandatory visioning sessions, you experience an unspoken but overwhelming pressure from said boss to contort your face to convey to everyone present that this is the greatest thing you've ever been a part of. You won't necessarily get in immediate trouble if you don't have the Olympic-level facial gymnastics skills to pull this off, but you do see your boss studying every face in the room and pondering, now who should I force, I mean invite, to plan this year's office party? Who in this room needs to learn a thing or two about good cheer? Then, at the end of said visioning process, a new plan has been developed collaboratively by the entire team. Sure, it sounds a lot like exactly what your boss wanted to make you do in the first place, but you're assured that indeed this turned out to be what you all wanted all along. That turned out to be handy for your boss. But more importantly, your boss tells you it's really amazing how this also brought everyone together as a team. Finally, you return to your workstation where you can finally let your contorted smile relax as you realize that A, you're now way behind on your current work projects, and B, that new vision that you just came up with has effectively doubled your workload. Sound familiar to anyone? Now, thankfully, I think that church visioning processes have rarely been that bad. But I certainly know that many of us also carry some baggage with those. For some of us, old church visioning experiences can feel like they maybe didn't go anywhere. Like we came up with a dozen new ideas, ran out of energy for them within 6 months, and then never spoke of it again. Or for some of us, the process can bring to mind experiences where we felt like failures at being church. Maybe visioning conjures up a memory of a time where you came up with goals like, say, our vision is to have 100 new members by the end of next month, and then it never happened, and you just kind of feel disillusioned. Or for some of us, the way that visioning has sometimes been done can leave us feeling like we're making church into something that it shouldn't be, like we're taking a place of worship, mystery, and relationship, and trying to turn it into some sort of formula for corporate-style growth. If these hang-ups or anything like them are what sees you when you hear the word visioning for this fall, well then, let me tell you that you are not alone. Firstly, these things have been part of some of our conversations as a leadership team, and a big part of why we chose a facilitator who we feel pretty confident understands visioning in a healthy and truly life-giving way. But more than that, let me tell you once again that if you feel this way, you have some incredible company in God's story. Picture this. In today's text, the people of God have just escaped their lives as slaves under Pharaoh's thumb in Egypt. After a dramatic escape, they have finally stopped to catch their breath at Mount Sinai and ask, "What now?" They're free, but now they have to figure out who they are outside of slavery and what they're actually supposed to be doing. It's time for them to discern their vision for their entire future as God's people, not Pharaoh's. This is no easy task. How hard is it? Well, the makeup of the book of Exodus should give us a pretty major clue. Consider this. Did you know that when you watch a movie like The Ten Commandments or Prince of Egypt, that you're actually only getting the first half of the entire book of Exodus? I mean, approximately half of this book is Hollywood gold. Slavery, a saved baby, a slave rising to the top of his slave master's government, a murder, an escape, a burning bush, a showdown with a pharaoh, plagues, plagues and more plagues, a parted sea. God meeting humanity in a pillar of fire. I mean, the first half of Exodus has got it all. But have you ever noticed that where these movie versions of Exodus end, there's still like 15 more chapters to go in this actual book? And why aren't those chapters in the movie, you ask? Well, I mean, have you ever tried to read those last 15 chapters? Have you? First, there's 6 chapters of God explaining in painstaking detail exactly how the people are supposed to make their ark, their tabernacle, their table for bread, their bronze altar, their court for the tabernacle, their priest's garments, their altar for incense, their bronze basin, even a lampstand and the oil for the lampstand. Then, a little while later, there's 5 more chapters that mostly just repeat the previous 16 chapters, but with "and then they" in front of each sentence, as in, God said, "Make the golden lampstands out of gold." And then they made the golden lampstands out of gold. There's like 15 chapters of this. No wonder Hollywood won't touch this whole story. I mean, even Ellen Davis, who's a professor of the Bible at Duke, admits to most modern eyes, these are arguably the most boring chapters in the entire Bible. Ouch. Move over genealogies, right? There's a new snooze fest in town. But here's what Davis also says, and here's where things get fascinating. Remarkably, the construction account is almost the exact same length as the story of Israel in Egypt, inviting the question, how could it possibly compete for interest and importance? How could all these details and repetition in the second half of this book possibly compete for importance with the exciting first half? Davis's answer is fascinating to me. She says, these 2 sections, the first about Israel's enslavement and the second about the construction of the tabernacle and all its related paraphernalia, are the 2 longest depictions of work in the entire Bible. As boring as the end of Exodus might be to read, by matching the length of its description of tabernacle construction work with its earlier description of slavery work, the Bible is showing us something. It's showing us how much work it's going to take for the people of God to do to unlearn what had been beaten into them by Pharaoh. If they want to unlearn the corrupt systems they were slaves to in Egypt, they're going to have to go through a pretty detailed and rigorous rehabilitation program. One that may not be equal in excitement for us as readers, but will be what it takes for them to reprogram themselves. It is rigorous, repetitive, and detailed. Its impact is going to have to outweigh all that stuff they internalized when all they knew was Pharaoh's system of slavery. Sure, they might be free now, but the only thing they've known is coercion and nonstop working to the bone in order to satiate Pharaoh's appetite for excess. And God's not about that. So as God's people arrive at Mount Sinai to envision what their future together could be and should be, the danger is that their concept of envisioning the future is still enslaved back in Egypt. So the Bible reminds us it takes a lot of diligence and attention to unlearn corrupt mindsets about how to plan and work. And so God puts them through a step-by-step recovery program as they build their new future. As with any recovery program, it's extensive, detailed, and painstaking. But most importantly, built into that recovery program are all kinds of lessons about what life with God's vision really looks like. And once you're looking for this in the text, you notice all kinds of interesting things, truly. All kinds of differences between God's program and Pharaoh's ways, which are clues to the lessons God is teaching God's people, like this. Again and again in these chapters, we hear, let all those whose hearts prompt them bring this or do that. And then, as they happen, the text emphasizes all over again. It keeps saying, and all those whose hearts were stirred and whose spirits were willing brought this or did that. So lesson number 1 in God's recovery of a godly vision program is this. Unlike Pharaoh's ways, or in our case, the corporate world's ways, God's vision is about stirring hearts and inspiring willing hearts. If our vision is coming to us from God, its tone will be invitational and inspirational. It won't be full of things that we have to threaten and pressure each other to do. If it is, we're probably letting the world's way of visioning taint ours. Godly vision stirs hearts and inspires spirits. Lesson number two of God's recovery of a godly vision program is this. Unlike Pharaoh's ways, or in our case, society's ways, God's vision is Sabbath-oriented. Time and again, these chapters repeat this too, as in Moses assembled all the congregation of the Israelites and said to them, "These are the things that the Lord has commanded you to do. 6 days shall work be done, but on the seventh day you shall have a Sabbath of solemn rest to the Lord." Now, I think this threat of death part is pretty uncomfortable for us today. That could be its whole own sermon, so I won't go too deep into that. But let me just say, when you read Exodus, when that comes up, that's like the underlining and highlighting. This is a really, really important commandment in here. And the really, really important commandment that keeps coming up is to rest. In Pharaoh's society, God's people's entire purpose as Pharaoh's slaves was to work. Rest was almost certainly limited to just enough to keep them working, not to pray or enjoy time with their family and one another. But in God's vision, the work of our calling must include Sabbath rest, which, as all of us who are tempted to sneak just a little work in on Sundays know, is already far more rest than we think we need. We may not be slaves in the traditional sense, but most of us definitely flirt with being slaves to our society's obsession with endless production. But not in God's vision. If our vision is coming from God's, it will be Sabbath-oriented, which means when we vision, our goal must not be to see how much more work and how many more commitments and obligations we can squeeze out of each other, but rather an answer to the question, what are we feeling called to that is part of a well-rounded life together? What are we feeling called to that includes more than enough time for us to rest, spend time with God, and simply enjoy one another's company? Because God's vision is Sabbath-oriented. Lastly, thirdly, while there are many other elements to God's recovery of a godly vision program worth exploring here, let's end today's lesson with this one. God's vision builds our future out of the unique gifts that each of us has to give. Just notice what God invites God's people to bring to construct the tabernacle. At first, it sounds like God's just being greedy. Bring gold, bring silver, bring bronze, bring blue, scarlet, purple yarns, bring fine twined linen, bring goat's hair, tanned ram's skins and goat skins, bring acacia wood, oil, spices, onyx stones, oh, and bring other stones too while you're at it. One can almost imagine Moses asking, "Lord, did you forget to mention the kitchen sink?" It all sounds kind of demanding and greedy, kind of non-willing hearty and non-Sabbath resty, right? But then we see it play out, and we should notice something. Those who felt moved to bring their gold jewelry bought their gold jewelry. Those who had silver or bronze brought that. Those who had blue or scarlet yarn brought that. Those who had fine linens brought fine linens. Those who had goat's hair or ram skins or goat skins brought those, and so on. When the people start responding to God's long lists of requests, it's clear. God's plan for them has included a ton of different valuable items because it's based on the unique combination of gifts that each person has. Not everyone has gold, so God's plan includes silver. Not everybody has silver, so God's plan involves bronze. But not everybody has gold, silver, or bronze, so God's plan includes yarn, linen, animal skins, wood, stones, many kinds. Under Pharaoh, we can imagine that some people's gifts for things like craftsmanship were probably exploited. But overall, if you're a slave, you're a peon. The plan is not designed to affirm or incorporate all your unique gifts. The plan is to do what Pharaoh wants. So you'd better forget what your unique abilities or gifts are and just do the thing that Pharaoh wants. But not when your plan grows out of a godly vision. In a godly vision, the plan is based on the unique gifts already possessed by God's people. And there isn't even a hierarchy here. God doesn't say, if you bring gold rather than silver, you'll get listed on the gold level of contributors in the program at the Tabernacle's opening gala. God says, bring what you have. It is absolutely essential. Whatever you have is absolutely essential to what we're building together. Because God's vision is gift-oriented. So, as we begin to prepare our minds and our hearts for a season of visioning, let's let our imaginations dance playfully with these three beautiful truths. God's vision is rooted in stirring hearts and willing spirits. God's vision is Sabbath-oriented. God's vision affirms and grows out of our unique collection of gifts. And believe me, it is unique here, our collection of gifts. Surely, this was incredibly good news to a group of recently escaped slaves wondering what to do next. And surely, it can be good news for us too, today. Can it not? So, how might we open ourselves to God, to a God whose vision is designed for stirred hearts and willing spirits? How might we prepare ourselves for a future that is Sabbath-oriented? How might we envision a future designed to fit our incredibly unique combination of gifts in this room? How might we prepare to grow into a future together where our hearts, minds, and souls are led by the love, grace, and wisdom of the one we follow, a God of vision?